We're going to air another new episode of the Mini Culture Podcast from season 9. Producer Gina Favano recounts for us her time in a community of folks actually living on the Mississippi River. You'll want to hear about this for certain. Trust me, if I know you folks who flock here to KFEI for Democracy Now!, you are going to dig this. Plus, your questions about what exactly is the difference between boat houses and house boats will be forever answered. Then, in the second half of the show, we are going to hear a number of news stories from the Mini Culture Collective. We will be learning about aging artists, sound baths, and live music marathons in stories from Allison Young, Sin Collins, and Joe Fredericks. But first, here is the Mini Culture Podcast, Season 9, Episode 6, Life on the Black Channel, from producer Gina Favano.
Welcome to Mini Culture, the podcast where we explore the people, stories, and cultural phenomena that make Minnesota, well, Minnesota. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. The Mississippi River is one of the defining geographic features of our state. The river's headwaters begin up north in Lake Itasca and meander for 650 miles through the cities, bluffs, forests, and iron ranges of Minnesota. The river has long captured our imagination, inspiring innovation, exploration, and creativity. And for many, it has provided a home. Boathouse communities, though less common today, have long formed up and down the river. These enclaves of shanty boats and floating homes provide affordable living and organic community for residents. Producer Gina Favano spent 10 years living in a boathouse on Latch Island, home to the only legally sanctioned year-round habitable boathouse community left on the Mississippi. She's documented this story of a floating neighborhood, their struggle to maintain their legality, and the people who call it home. Here's Gina.
A back channel is an unofficial communication channel, a place used to make informal or subversive negotiations. It's a term you hear a lot in political contexts to describe a line of communique, a backdoor entrance. Ultimately, it's a conduit, a stream that connects ideas. Geographically speaking, the back channel is the smaller of two channels in a river that diverge to form an island. The main channel hosts the immense barge traffic, the commerce. It's the primary channel, the mainstream. But here on the back channel, we're more underground, and it's potentially always under threat. This is a story about Latch Island, home to the only legally sanctioned year-round community of habitable boathouses left on the Mississippi River. It's near the town of Winona, Minnesota. Imagine a mosaic of small floating dwellings. Hundreds of turtles climb out of the muck to sun themselves on black logs slick with neon green duckweed. Gar spawn in the shallows between them, their lurching mating dance virtually unchanged for eons. When seen from above, the boathouses present a multi-hued variegated quilt, at once rugged and quaint. Each boathouse is unique, each shape specially dictated by necessity, resources, and the vision of the builder. Most of them are small. Picture a shack with one or two rooms built upon an undercarriage made of floating blue plastic barrels. These structures are tied to the shore and most have a little walkway. Much of what happened in this area prior to about 1750 is unrecorded. What we do know is that at some point, probably not too long after Native people were violently displaced, other people, mostly poor people, started building shacks along the river near what would become Latch Island. Actually down the entire length of the Mississippi. Gertie Tonjum's a woodworker and shantyboat builder who's traversed many rivers. He's also a longtime resident of Lower Latch Island, what's also known colloquially as Wolf Spider Island.
Well, the first time I ever walked on one of these places, it just felt different than living on land. Like, I always say that I finally felt grounded, which is kind of weird to think of water being grounding, but it is. I just, like, instantly felt super comfortable. The community was and still is really interesting to me because you're living in the middle of the Mississippi River. At the whim of nature, you kind of instantly have something in common with people around here, and you help each other because you just completely out of necessity, you have to rely on each other a little bit, you know.
This next clip is from an old VHS tape from the 80s that I discovered from a local TV show that used to exist called The Spirit of Winona. Here, the host explains the difference between houseboats and boathouses.
Hello, I'm Joyce Woodworth. Welcome to the Spirit of Winona. Across the river from Winona is Latch Island. On the other side of that island stands numerous boathouses. The term boathouses is really a misnomer here because most of the so-called boathouses do not house boats. They're actually river houses with plastic barrels underneath to keep them afloat, and inside are the residences of over 100 or so people, some of whom live year-round in these interesting establishments.
Wolf Spider is the smaller island. It's just below the main island known as Latch. It sits adjacent to the back channel of the Mississippi River, across from the town of Winona, Minnesota, near the Wisconsin border.
Is that the family of nine?
No. Oh, yeah.
Here I'm counting ducks with my former boathouse neighbor, John Rupke.
There's also a family of six that just came by earlier today.
These are seven. These are seven. Seven ducks.
It's a different family.
Yeah,
that's a different family.
One, two, three, four, five. Six,
yeah.
Seven.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, but no, they're leaving.
No,
what?
No,
so,
no,
they're
eight,
joining up.
No,
with more.
They're one, two, three, four, five, six, seven.
John Rupke, the unofficial history keeper of Latch Island, spent much of his adult life living as a member of the Religious Order of Christian Brothers, which is similar to a priest. When he came out to live as a gay man in his early 40s, he bought a little boathouse, aka floating home. On Latch Island, he found community and became a central figure in preserving the legacy of the Latch Island boathouses. Around this time, he also began a practice of writing anti-oppression-themed letters to the local newspapers. Here he is reading a section of one that was published during the first Trump administration.
Can you read this last paragraph out loud, starting from there? Millions.
Millions of Americans are now willing to sacrifice their God-given intelligence on Trump's altar because they have been programmed to really believe that truth is whatever they want it to be. This is today's infallible Republican doctrine. Truth will set you free. The delusion of truth will enslave you.
John wasn't always the type of person to assert his opinion or take on leadership roles in eccentric, radical subcultures. His story started out much differently in 1950 Chicago.
I never made a decision not to come out of the closet. It was just, that's the way you lived. When you were a teenager in the 50s. I remember when I was a teenager one day standing in front of the mirror and looking in the mirror and saying, well, I guess you're a homosexual. I was like singing it to myself. And then it was like going from there, going on from there, you know. It was like, because not only was I a homosexual, but I was the only one in the world.
This sentiment sums up perfectly how it can feel as a young person to know you're outside the realm of quote-unquote normal society, an outsider, and the isolation that can come with that, especially in the days before the internet, when there wasn't that window out into a vast world of information. And the 50s really was a different era. It was a time when the Lavender Scare was in full swing. The Lavender Scare was a program implemented by the US government in 1950. It was a so-called moral panic, launched to out gay people, have them dismissed from their jobs, and sometimes worse. It paralleled the anti-communist McCarthy hearings, which decreed that homosexuals were communist sympathizers and morally corrupt, thus posing a threat to the U.S. government. John, as a young man wondering what to do in the next chapter of life, thought about joining the seminary to study becoming a Christian brother. In that cloistered environment, he'd be free from many of the complications that being gay during that time period posed. John served as a brother for 24 years, quietly enduring his ongoing repression until the national cultural shift that took place in the 1960s and 70s. There was a growing gay movement in the U.S., and it slowly emboldened him to make the changes he needed to make in his own life. In 1979, John, at age 43, decided to visit San Francisco, a city known for being a stronghold for the gay rights movement, and it was a trip that changed everything.
I went to Haight-Ashbury, and right on the corner of Haight-Ashbury is a gay bar. So I had never been in a gay bar, so I walked in. Here's all these people dancing, and music is, you know, it was like disco, the beat, you know. And I, so I went and I sat over pretty close to the microphones that were blaring out the beat, and I sat there, and it was like, that's when I came out. That was my coming out moment.
The next year, John took a standard leave of absence from the Brotherhood. Then soon after that, he officially left and bought a boathouse on Latch Island.
So somebody had an advertisement for a boathouse for sale, $400. And they said, well, we got this one here. This is the winner. You can have that for $400. We're not sure if it'll float. I think it's on the ground now. The river was low. And I said, okay, well, I'll take my chances. I bought it. It was like, wow, this is really cool, this little boathouse.
It was here on the back channel, in this barely floating one-room home, where John began to build a new community for himself, albeit a small one at that point. John Rupke was finally able to explore who he truly was.
Do you think you ended up in the counterculture mostly because you were gay, or do you think you would have kind of ended up here anyway?
Well, that's a good question. I think I certainly wasn't into counterculture when I was a brother. Okay, so that's 44 years and living in monasteries and teaching in conservative Catholic schools. But when I left and came into the boathouse, it was, my being gay was not a problem in the counterculture, which was, wow, that was a huge thing.
When John moved onto the island in 78, there were already a fair amount of boathouses being inhabited. It's hard to get an actual count. Less than 50. But around the same time, the city started to take issue with the boathouses. Or more accurately, the city manager, who wasn't from Winona, and perhaps didn't fully appreciate the cultural significance of the floating community. The issue started in 1976, when the city of Winona was awarded a Minnesota state grant to pay for half of the purchase of Latch Island. Prior to that, most of it had been owned by the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. So, Winona buys Latch Island, under the stipulation that it gets used as a public park, where folks could connect with the water, fish, enjoy nature. It's been speculated that perhaps the city manager alerted the Army Corps of Engineers to the boathouse situation. And it's been suggested, both on and off the record, that the boathouses only became an issue when the grant was awarded for the city to purchase the island. But basically, they didn't want squatters there. Like a lot of histories, though, some of the context is murky. The whole situation for Latch Island involved various different types of government agencies. There was the city manager, the Army Corps of Engineers, city council, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and it was of concern to both the Minnesota and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, or the DNR, as they get called sometimes.
The Army Corps of Engineers set December 31st, 1979, as the deadline to get rid of all habitable boathouses.
So if you'll recall from earlier, the city of Winona officially purchased Latch Island in the late 70s from a grant they got from the state of Minnesota. However, no provision had been made within the agreement as to what, if anything, should happen with the boathouses. And at that point, there were quite a few of them. Later that same year, the Army Corps of Engineers got an order from the Pentagon to remove habitable boathouses from federal land by December 31st, 1979, as John stated earlier. But Latch Island technically was no longer federal land. It had become an island that was owned by the city. John and other boathousers believed they had a right to live here.
Yeah, it was a precedent, really.
Reggie McLeod is the creator of Big River Magazine. Around the time the issues with the boathouses were unfolding, he was writing for the local newspapers. His reporting was by and large unbiased, but he also had a reference for the cultural importance of boathouses.
A lot of the people in Winona, people older than I, remember growing up when there were more people living along the river. You know, they slowly disappeared everywhere else. This is the last year-round boathouse community on the river that I know about. It was like a culture war thing. It kind of offended their sensibilities that people could live so cheaply.
Reggie McLeod's writing and coverage of specific events, both in and out of court, had a role in helping the islanders spread the word about their case. But they also had other allies in their quest to remain in their homes. One of them lived in a boathouse.
We tried to stay under the radar over here, you know, but the thing we had, our ace in the hole, was that Judge Chalene was living here.
The late Judge Dennis Chalene, as John just mentioned, lived on Latch Island in the early days. He also authored multiple books on criminal law and toured throughout the U.S. and Canada, lecturing on his what was then considered new concepts of sentencing. Here he is being interviewed on a local TV show in the 1980s.
One day, I had a guy who came into court and I fined him $100.
The audio isn't the best, but basically, this guy who was fined $100 didn't fully understand who he was talking to.
And he says, Judge, if I have to pay that kind of money, he says, I'm going to be so broke I have to live down in one of them shacks on the river. Well, everybody started laughing in court because they know the judge lives in a shack on the river. And so he didn't know what was so funny. He left, and I don't think he knew until somebody told him later on that that was the wrong thing to say to the wrong person.
Not only was Judge Chalene a key player in securing the legal rights of the boathouse colony, but in the early 70s, he began the nation's first program sentencing nonviolent offenders to community service instead of jail time. Considered controversial and without legal precedent, it's now commonplace both nationally and internationally. Swamp boat justice, he called it. Here he is again being interviewed by news anchor Tom Snyder.
What kinds of people come before you? How do you see them?
I see them as you and I, the same kind of people that perhaps make mistakes in life. You know, it's amazing how the juvenile delinquent's always that kid down the end of the block. You know, he's never our kid.
Right.
But everybody's got to be somebody's kid. And consequently, that's how I look at them.
The slight protection that was afforded when Judge Chalene lived on the island helped the early community buy some time to figure out the next steps in protecting their floating homes. What happened over the next 15 or so years involved a series of legal battles with various government organizations. The islanders were also bolstered by immense support from their extended community. Eventually, in 1997, the Winona Boathouse Association was established as an incorporated nonprofit, which also meant the boathouses became more regulated. Not all of the residents were happy about this change. There were rules about what materials you could use to build your house, and some saw it as a path for potential gentrification. But the nonprofit status did afford the island some legal standing for the first time. Meanwhile, a burgeoning culture was being developed by the boathousers. New freedoms found in this way of living were being explored. New relationships were being forged.
Was Norm your partner?
Yeah, that's Norm. No.
John and Norm met at a Halloween party in Winona in the early 80s and soon realized they had much in common, including a shared ethos for wanting to create a new way of living.
That's how I met him, and we ended up at this house and talked all night, you know.
They had a happy life together, there on the back channel, living side by side in their respective floating homes. Partners. Despite the fact that life for the boathouse dwellers at that point could often seem separate from more conventional aspects of society, there were still outside factors that impacted them. In 1985, Norm received some troubling test results. He found out that he was HIV positive.
Of course, that you can believe that that was a real blow, not only because Norm was HIV positive, but was like, oh, well, where does that leave me? So I went and got tested in La Crosse, because in those days it was not easy to get tested.
Yeah.
And I came out negative.
AIDS in America in 1985, at the height of the epidemic and the accompanying stigma. There were so many unknowns. It would be another year before Ronald Reagan would even mention AIDS in public.
Not that much was known about HIV, you know, and AIDS. I remember he was reluctant to pee in the river. Is that going to contaminate? You know, I remember him thinking about that as time went on. Things got worse and worse, and so it was like when he died, it was like it was a relief for me that he was no longer in a process of continuing downhill suffering.
Yeah.
By the time he died, he was like a old blind man.
How old was he?
39.
Thousands of people died during this time, many of them young and previously healthy. Their deaths due in no small part to the Reagan administration that remained largely silent and unresponsive until it was too late to help so many. Norm died in 1989, many years before I began living on the island. John stayed. He didn't want to live anywhere else. Besides, John had settled into a routine of living. Every season on the island is distinct. Some months you can walk the path, some months you can only wade or boat in because of the flooding. And all of this is meticulously noted in the logs on his bookshelves. In the deep winter months, you can walk out on the ice road that forms when the back channel freezes over. Even with all these variations, there's rhythm, there are cycles that repeat. Spaces like these where people can find themselves or heal themselves or even just be themselves are always going to be important. The future of the island's always been uncertain. From its history of trouble with bureaucracy to taciturn flood seasons and barge traffic that erodes the sand away over time. That's echoed in the boathouses themselves, how they move and shift over the water. This current era of uncertainty feels a little different though, more tied into climate change and gentrification and the housing insecurity being experienced on a national level, capitalism essentially. Chances are they'll continue to be boathouses here down the line. But what will they look like, and who will own them, and how often will they get used?
Okay, this is the Lower Latch Island Declaration of Independence. Subtitled, Ode to the Lower Latch Island Footbridge. We built the bridge that the police won't cross. It spans the cut that stopped the phone company. Yet each day it allows to pass, like smoke through a screen, the children and dogs and adults who know its secrets. The city boathouse inspector won't cross it either. We built the perfect bridge. It is two opposing gangplanks to a river house porch that rises and falls on six barrels. In double 2x4 barrel racks, exactly 16 inches apart. It focuses the attention of our visitors on the question of balance and prepares them to approach our homes. A steel cable passes through two metal rings attached to the upstream side and holds the bridge to trees on opposite banks. Vines creep along the cable, reaching out to greet approaching friends. A single downstream rope keeps it from twisting in the current. Motorcycles can't cross it. Vroom, vroom, vroom. It rises and falls in a free-swinging arc. It's fun to cross. Lots of times I play games on it. The city litter pickers don't cross it either. So our trail is litter-free. It is a proper bridge to begin the journey down the Lower Latch Island Trail through the heart of the Lower Latch Island primitive wilderness area. We built the perfect bridge. By John Rupke, Chief Gardener of the Lower Latch Island Trail, July 4th, 1981.
Thank you. KFAI, this is Gina Favano.
This episode was written and produced by Gina Favano. Portions of this episode were originally published as part of Gina's podcast, Back Channel Radio, which explores the Latch Island community in much more depth. You can listen to the podcast in its entirety at backchannelradio.org. Gina is also writing a book about Latch Island based on her reporting. You can learn more and support her work at patreon.com/backchannelradio. Special thanks to Suzanne Hogan of KCUR in Kansas City, who was the producer for Back Channel Radio. Music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions, Come Holy Spirit, and The Wax Lyricist. The voices of Tom Snyder and Joyce Woodward were featured in this story. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sensulo. More episodes are coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed to Mini Culture wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Thanks for listening.
The Minnesota Cuba Committee and KFAI invite you to discover Cuba through the cinematic lens of the 16th annual Minnesota Cuban Film Festival. Films are shown on six consecutive Wednesday evenings from April 30th to June 4th, 7 p.m. at the Main Cinema on Minneapolis's historic waterfront. See and hear about Cuba from the viewpoint of Cubans living there. For more information and tickets, go to mspfilm.org or find the Minnesota Cuban Film Festival page on Facebook.
You're listening to Veterans Voices, the first Gulf War.
I'm Chief Master Sergeant Lisa Erickson. I'm currently assigned to the Minnesota Air National Guard. I am the Command Senior Enlisted Leader for the state of Minnesota. So I serve in the Air National Guard, but I also have oversight of the Minnesota National Guard. I've been in for 37 years. I started my career in the active duty Air Force, so I was active duty Air Force during the time of the Gulf War. The day came that we got our orders for our next duty assignment, and I was selected for Kadena Air Force Base, Okinawa, Japan, and I was a jet engine mechanic. Barely knew lefty, loosey, righty, tighty, and I was going to be a jet mechanic, and my dad just laughed. He was like, you don't even know how to put gas in your car, but I figured it out. There I was. I was one of two girls, and there was probably 30 of us in the shop. Five crews of six, and there was just two of us females sprinkled amongst those crews. Our airman that I worked with really wanted to get into the fight, really wanted to go over and work in the Middle East and be there. But we were already on a mission in the PACOM area, in the PACAF. We weren't deployed, but we had to supply the motors for that. The biggest thing that we were all like, oh, you know, and we're really a part of the big picture because our motors were being used by those airplanes that were helping fight the fight.
Veterans Voices, the First Gulf War, is produced by AMPRS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, and is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
With traditional Scandinavian open hands and warm hearts, the Cedar Cultural Center's Nordic Roots series brings you a very special evening with Ali Moeller and Bruce Molsky, Tuesday, May 13th. Multi-Grammy-winning, multi-instrumentalist Ali Moeller is an icon in the Nordic folk and world music scene. Trying to list all of his achievements and awards is as impossible as trying to list all of the instruments he's mastered. Joining him is Americana folk legend Bruce Molsky. Together, their technical skills and conversational wit promise to create a show that feels less like a concert and more like a front porch get-together. Tickets for an evening with Ali Moeller and Bruce Molsky can be found at the Cedar's website. Visit thecedar.org for more details.
You are tuned in to Mini Culture Presents, KFAI's sound and documentary showcase program. Earlier we heard season 9 of the Mini Culture podcast, episode 6, Life on the Back Channel, from producer Gina Favano. Come back next week for another new installment. But if you cannot wait that long, you can just subscribe to the podcast and you will even get to hear our next episode just a few days earlier. than I get to here. Plus, you will get to be able to listen to all great 8 seasons of this award-winning Minnesota show, full of terrific arts, history, and culture stories about our wonderful state. And if you'd like to help keep the wheels of Miniculture churning, please consider making a pledge to Miniculture's radio home. KFEI relies on your financial support. You can make a difference and a donation today at kfei.org by clicking donate. Your dollars make a tremendous difference here, and your part in creating people-powered public radio is essential to keeping this KFEI alive and kicking. So thank you very much. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members just like yourself and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, radio without boundaries. Support for Miniculture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And as promised, I've got a batch of freshly made Miniculture stories for you right now about aging artists, sound baths, and live music marathons, and stories from Allison Young, Sin Collins, and Joe Fredericks. Here's Julie.
You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Dewey Goodwin is a Minnesota artist and sculptor who lives near Bemidji. A member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe, Goodwin has been making art for nearly 50 years. In recent years, however, health issues have made it challenging for Goodwin to make art. KFAI's Joe Fredericks spoke with Goodwin about how he plans to continue to create in the years ahead.
His work lines the prairies. It stands near the great river, the Mississippi. The sculptures he's been creating for nearly 5 decades are present in many pockets of Minnesota, from university campuses to the state's capital city. And he knows his time to create is running short.
I'm a Dewey Goodwin, Anishinaabe artist.
Dewey, who lives near Bemidji, is a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. He grew up as one of 14 children on the White Earth Reservation. He was interested in art from a young age, drawing and painting what he saw with his eyes and in his mind. Dewey left the small town of Manoman when he was 16, dropping out of school and heading west the day after Christmas in 1969. He took a bus or he hitchhiked, catching a ride at one point from Wichita to Salt Lake City with 2 college students who were continually huffing something out of a brown paper bag as they drove west.
Crazy damn college kids. They were going back to school, back to college.
Drove through the night, huh?
Yeah, big sedan, 4-door.
Dewey ended up in San Francisco, where he experienced the 1960s. After a few years of mind-altering experiences, he returned to Minnesota. When he did, he reconnected with the woman that he would eventually marry, Bambi. I went to visit Bambi and Dewey on their farm near Bemidji in August. Large pine, oak, and birch trees line the family's driveway, which starts off a dusty gravel road about 10 miles from town. There are apple trees, too, and Bambi's garden near the driveway is overflowing with red ripened tomatoes and dark green cucumbers. Bambi was there to greet me at the end of their long driveway, as were a couple of family dogs.
Stay down. He'll jump up and poke you with his nose, so just make sure.
He's got a toy.
And
really?
So come on in.
2 dogs.
We don't have air conditioning, but we do have...
I don't have air
conditioning.
Dewey!
You got company. Get up.
Now in his 70s, Goodwin is most well known as a sculptor who primarily works in stone. He started working with stone during his teen years, he says. His first piece was a ceremonial pipe carved from pipestone.
All the rock was a pipestone.
From Minnesota?
Yeah, pipestone, yeah.
What did you do with that?
I still have it. I used a jackknife in the file.
Has it ever been used, the pipe?
Yeah, I retired it.
In addition to a log home that they built on the property, Dewey also has a working art studio. He's been making art for most of his life, he says, though his studies at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design and the Institute of American Indian Art in Santa Fe, New Mexico, elevated his passion to create to a more robust level. People can visit some of Dewey's most prominent sculptures. They're along the Mississippi River in Grand Rapids, at Indian Mound State Park in St. Paul, and at the University of Minnesota Morris campus. The sculptures portray the reality of life for indigenous people in Minnesota, a mixture of embracing their culture and a remembrance of pain inflicted through colonization. The English translation for the sculpture Dewey made at the UM Morris campus is called Grandmother Water Woman. The sculpture stands near the site of a former boarding school, a painful association for some indigenous families in Minnesota whose ancestors attended the boarding school that once stood on the land of the University of Minnesota Morris campus. Goodwin says the sculpture symbolizes the journey of the Native American from a traditional people to an assimilated but still proud community. They have endured colonization, he says, retaining their most valued traditions, their identity, language, ceremonies, and arts.
As you can see, Joe, our culture is not much left to it. Now we want to try to preserve what we have left so our grandkids have something to be proud of, so no one die ever die away.
In addition to the motivation to continue making art, Dewey is moved and spirited by the next generation that he sees on a regular basis around his home, namely his grandchildren. He wants his art to inspire them, Dewey says, and for them to embrace their indigenous roots.
Their next generation. Because you want to teach your kids the right things in life. Only way to teach them is to be around them. Live with them.
You think they'll have a better experience as Native Americans in society than you?
Oh, yeah. My start as a Native American years ago was rough. Growing up with racism, bigoted people. Precious people looking down at you. Right away, you think you're less because people look down at you. Makes you feel like you're less. Kids are proud of it. They don't have to step down from nobody. It's just equal to everybody else.
Dewey has suffered numerous physical setbacks over his life that have made creating more sculptures a challenge. Looking back, Dewey has suffered two heart attacks in recent years. He severely damaged his arm during a wild rice processing accident several years ago. In an incident with other indigenous people during the height of the American Indian Movement, Dewey was shot and broke his tibia. Later, he got a nail in his eye when he was trying to make repairs on the family's deck. In September 2024, Goodwin had a major surgery on his shoulder. He's scheduled for another operation in January, this time to repair his knee. He would like to make at least one more major sculpture, he says. That is a goal. The will is there. It's only a question of what the body will allow. Even with the injuries, it appeared that nothing could keep Dewey, Bambi, and I from swimming in the clear, cool upper reaches of the Mississippi River just before darkness fell on the first night of my visit.
Frog, see him?
Hey, Toad.
Big old guy. Well, it's nice.
Cold.
This is the Mississippi.
Mississippi River.
Yeah, it's a little bit chilly, Dad. A little bit chilly.
I know it's a bit chilly.
You want a hand, Dewey?
Yeah.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. You just got to walk in and dive in. Oh, Jesus, it's cold. No, it's not bad.
Okay, it was warm. Push you right down the river. It's warm, Dad.
It does, huh?
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. This last August, six bands of musicians with varying experience levels who had never played together before all got together to compete in a 48-hour band contestival at Palmer's Bar in Minneapolis. A local record collective began the contestival nearly 20 years ago after they heard about similar events in other cities. Following a several-year hiatus, organizer Luke Parker brought the contestival back to a large and enthusiastic audience. KFAI's Sin Collins spoke with Luke and some of the participants.
And last but not least, maybe least, we'll see. Otto! Tommy, Nicholas, Paul Huda.
On a beautiful weekend in mid-August, Luke Parker relaunched the 48-hour band contestival for the first time in 8 years. Musicians sign up, are randomly selected, and placed in bands. After 48 hours, the new bands perform their first show at the 48-hour contestival. This year, Palmer's Bar invited Luke to revive the 48-hour band contestival at their location on the patio.
Okay. On your marks, get set, go. Thank you. See you Saturday.
Over 10 years, organizer Luke Parker has been in several 48-hour band contestivals as an MC, a judge, and in many of the bands, a couple who won.
I've won once. I got second place one time.
It's all blur, but it was a fun blur.
The 48-hour band contestival was started in 2007 or 2008. It was like a year before my time, by some members of a record collective, band collective called Anti-Civ Records. Basically been like the best idea that came out of this kind of drunken, like, disorganized record collective we had.
It has been 8 years since they had a contest at the Hexagon.
Towards the end of it, the last couple years, I kind of took over and was doing a lot of the work of organizing. And the last time I tried to do it was 2017, and not enough people signed up, and so it was canceled.
At the beginning of the 2024 contestival, Luke was a bit apprehensive about how many people would participate. But by the time signups were underway, he was feeling more optimistic.
It's the sign-up day. We're sitting at 17 people right now, which is pretty good. We got about an hour left until we announce them. My goal is to have 25, 28, maybe 30.
People of all kinds sign up for the 48-hour band contestival, writing down instruments they play and their schedule. Luke randomly draws their names and puts them into bands. There might be multiple players of an instrument.
You can have two drummers, you can have three drummers, you can have all guitar players, you can have just voices. It's not like it has to be guitar, bass, drums, or something like that. So. Oh, signing up! Okay. Well, info down there. This year we have a 15-year-old. There's actually this year a lot of new faces. The point is kind of shrink the city in some ways. People just getting to know each other.
That's a community idea.
I think it's a really good idea, and it's more for the people. This isn't like a First Avenue draft of like already established musicians. This is not a bad turnout, and I think we can make it work. So I think that we'll give it a whirl.
Attendees like Kaylee Suyan, who works at the Cedar, look forward to this contestival.
I'm so excited that Luke brought back the 48-hour band contest because it's going to be incredibly fun seeing the new music come out.
It's time for the selection process to begin.
Okay, so we're doing six bands of four. Band two.
Brian Nanoff, Malachi, Jess Buns, David Leeds.
The musicians immediately meet with their new fellow band members and discuss their strategies. The four who will become Slovender are excited about the 48 hours ahead. Some are seasoned musicians, one just moved here from New York, and one is new to performing on a stage.
My name is Brian. I think our plan is just to get together tomorrow afternoon and write some songs.
My name is David. I play drums and percussion, and I thought this would be a fun time and looking forward to seeing what we can do.
My name is Malachi. Yeah, we're going to write songs.
There is already a multiple drummer dilemma discussion.
Going with the idea of maybe two drummers? Maybe two drummers in a group?
Malachi, whose father is musician, guitar tech, and live sound engineer Brian Herb, is the youngest 48-hour band contestable contestant this year at age 15.
I guess, like, my dad's music has always kind of been, like, weird time signature stuff, and I've tried to get into that. So one day I'm going to do that.
Hello from Palmer's Patio. It's Saturday night. The 48-hour band contestable begins. Slovender singer Jess is performing the contestable for the second time in 10 years.
We've had a really good time. Me, David, Brian, and Malachi got together yesterday at like 3 p.m. and we practiced for about 2 hours and we came up with enough material to do something tonight, and it's really fun. We were told that there would be plenty of drum kit stuff to use, but apparently there's not, so we're just having a band meeting now to figure out what we're gonna do.
Luke gathers multi-talented judges for the contestable. This year's judges were musicians, artists, a booker, and a comedian, Devon Bland. He loved Slovender.
Wow, listen, they had two drummers. Both drummers were amazing, no matter how old they are, or the fact that one of their moms was like, that's my baby! They get a 9 out of 10.
Give it up again for every band that put themselves together in the last 48 hours. Amazing work.
Such a fantastic event. Give it up for these judges for being amazing. Give it up for Luke Parker, and then one more time for Wizard, and one more time for Slovender.
Slovender took fourth place, though they were a top contender for Judge Devon.
I think my top bands was Wizard and Slovender. I like Slovender a lot because they had a great groove.
Luke was happy with the success of the 48-hour band contestable.
It's always mind-blowing, like, what people can come up with in 2 days. The quality of stuff that people do. That's the whole point of the thing, really.
I'm Sin Collins for KFAI.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Every other Thursday evening at St. Mark's Cathedral, sound therapist Annie Fitzgerald leads a one-hour meditation using sound. This meditation, called a sound journey, is a type of healing modality that transports a participant to a dreamlike state of vibrational healing. KFAI producer Allison Young took part in a recent sound journey and shares the tingling and tantalizing sounds of this ancient practice.
I'm lying on a yoga mat, along with about a dozen or so other people, our heads nestled comfortably on soft pillows. We're in a circle, tracing a labyrinth painted on the floor. Crystal singing bowls and a velvety voice fill Whipple Chapel at St. Mark's Cathedral in Minneapolis. The room is lit only by candles and the angled rays of sunlight coming through stained glass. I'd heard about sound journeys before, and I was intrigued. It's a practice that uses sound vibrations to enhance well-being, and it's less a musical concert and more of a healing meditation, a kind of sound bath, as singer-songwriter Annie Fitzgerald explains.
When I write a song, there is structure. There's a lyrical structure. There's a structure to the song itself. When I am facilitating sound journeys, I don't necessarily know what I'm going to play. I am literally working with the energy that everyone brings into the room, which is different every single time. It also depends on the energy that's swirling around in the world right now.
Sound has great power to move us. Just think about your favorite songs that might be upbeat or might put you in a more contemplative mood. Certain frequencies and timbres can stir emotions and elicit specific reactions. Recently, scientists have learned that sound can affect our physical bodies as well. Like brainwave entrainment, that's when large-scale electrical oscillations in our bodies naturally synchronize to the rhythm of external stimuli. Even more promising are recent in vitro experiments where sound has caused resonance inside DNA and it's brought about healing. For Annie Fitzgerald, her journey has taken her from opera to musical theater to songstress and now a certified sound therapist. Her orchestra of prayer bowls, chimes, shakers, rattles, drums, and gongs serve a dual purpose of relaxation and restoration.
So I use the instruments in very specific ways as an offering in order to help us sort of move and clear energy that isn't serving us, because certain frequencies work with different parts of our body and then to help fill everything back up again.
Some instruments are soothing, like seed pods that sound like frogs, or koshi chimes and flow chimes that feel like a caress on the ear. Other instruments are more intense, like the gong and the ocean drum, a large container filled with pellets that sounds like rain or waves.
Some sounds can sort of make you feel uncomfortable, and it sometimes feels like it's a pressure valve, that it's kind of building, 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 and then there's a pop, but that's literally just the energy that's moving and clearing.
To invite us fully into the space, Fitzgerald asks us to set an intention so that she and everyone in the room can act as witness to our journey. What is special and unique to her practice is not only that she sings, but how she interacts with participants. She stands right over me and strikes a buffalo drum, deep and resonant, and I can feel it in my solar plexus.
My intention when I'm doing it in the beginning is just to connect everyone's hearts, because I'm actually am playing the heartbeat. And so a lot of times I get to see everyone just sort of smile. They sort of just smile and light up a little bit.
Beginning this November, Annie Fitzgerald's sound journey will be part of a new program, a holistic wellness community at St. Mark's. The program will explore multifaceted healing modalities, including yoga, grief circles, somatic practitioners, food as medicine, art therapy, and more. Called the Sanctuary at St. Mark's, their mission is to be, quote, a place for healing the heart of the city in the heart of the city. And of course, Sound Journeys continues at the cathedral every other Thursday.
The Sound Journey meditation can also help anchor in the joy and the love and all of the good things that are going on for people too. So it depends on how you show up.
For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Support for Mini Culture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Mini Culture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/minneculture.
You have been tuned into Mini Culture Presents here on KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. If you'd like to hear any of these stories again, you can find them and share them with your pals at Mini Culture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. My name is Michael Whetstone. This has been Mini Culture Presents. Let's meet here again next week for the final episode of the Mini Culture podcast from Season 9. It is going to be a good one, a history of the Underground Railroad in Minnesota. So until then, take care and keep on keeping on, as they say. But right now, I'm going to leave you with the very latest release of KFAI favorite Black Market Brass, stirring up some Twin Cities Afrobeat funk with Obi Original. The physical vinyl single for this 45 just dropped this past Friday, and it is available now at all fine Twin Cities record outlets and Bailey Brothers, which is owned and operated by a former KFAI programmer, DJ Father Time. In fact, you may even still be able to get your hands on the orange creamsicle color variant vinyl if you're lucky. Here is Battle Ready by Black Market Brass.